This episode of AVXL was recorded on October 4th, 2018. We're going to talk about the Big Lebowski on 4K. Robert wept, people. Calvo's new control center, the price of that 85-inch Samsung 8K TV, Netgear's Orbi speaker, some badass entry-level audio gear, and so much more.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater and audio gear, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Dorn, and I'm talking really fast today.
You have coffee.
I slept for like 7 hours last night.
I had the most beautiful German meal last night. It's October, so my local German pub goes full on Oktoberfest, and I think the sauerkraut just, I don't know, it was all so delicious. I had like a Swiss brat, sauerkraut, and the German potatoes, and oh, it's delicious. But for whatever reason, suddenly I am the easiest of sleepers, and I just couldn't get to sleep. I was like, what's going on?
Apparently you didn't have enough fine German beer to wash it all down.
Apparently not. No, I actually had none. I should have probably partaken, but I was busy watching the A's exit post-play in the great game of baseball.
Too soon.
So, yeah, it is too soon.
Too soon.
Next season. And I got my flu shot, so I'm super happy. I feel invincible for another year.
Oh, I should take all the family to get injected. That'll be fun. I wish I was at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest. Hey, if you're in Denver or if you're in a driving distance to Denver and you like audio, you really should be at Rocky Mountain Audio Fest this weekend. I had some familial commitments that prevented my travel this year. But
seriously.
It runs Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the October 5th through the 7th. It's amazing because essentially they take over the Denver Marriott Tech Center. And
oh, sweet. That whole area is just awesome.
Yeah. There's a can jam there. So literally just about every headphone and earbud manufacturer will be there. And then they have hotel rooms full of speakers. ELAC, Paradigm,
open to the public?
PS Audio.
For
yeah,
a fee?
You got to pay.
Yeah.
But it's not that expensive. It's pretty awesome.
Colorado.
HeadFi is a cool preview of all the headphone audio gear there. I think that horrible $400,000 speaker we saw is going to be there.
Oh, work of art.
It was a work of art. You know, this is not that speaker. It just looks like it.
I hear you. It's fun to watch other people fawn over it.
Yes. They also do panels, which is pretty cool. And
always cool if you can come across the right group of speakers.
Yeah.
Talking about some subject you're interested in. And they always end up doing Q&A afterward.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. I was sitting at a panel one day and being like, oh, that's three of the most successful speaker designers in the industry. And they're sitting up there answering questions.
Talking shop. Cool thing about Colorado too. It's relatively easy to get to from most of the United States. Transportation's great around either the convention center or in the Marriott Tech Center. This is probably one of the best times of the year to go. It's not too hot, not too cold. If you need any excuse at all to hit the Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, there you go. Just go. Go get a cheap flight.
Oh my goodness.
Stay anywhere in the damn city. That's their public transit's amazing.
Yeah,
it all works.
So I'm looking at like the list of exhibitors.
If you can tolerate the altitude.
Yeah, well, that's the exciting part. One more, 64 Audio, Abyss.
One more.
Like Allo Audio, Alclair, Amphion.
Nice.
It just kind of goes on. Astell and Kern, Odyssey. And that's like half of the things listed on the first page. Audio Research, Audio Engine.
AudioFest.net.
AN Audio, Bang & Olufsen, Beyer Dynamic, Bowers & Wilkins. We mentioned their new 600 series are really impressive.
Might be some of my most favorite speakers of all.
Bryston, Cartage, Cambridge Audio, Carey Audio, Cord, Class A, Constellation, Dan D'Agostino, Deconi, who makes ear pads, DeVore Fidelity.
So this isn't just like a can jam where it's just headphones. It's everything.
It's headphones and speakers.
All your audio.
Amplifiers.
Okay, cool.
Turntables. Let's see, ELAC. Oh my goodness. It just kind of goes on and on.
Audio Fest.
FIO's there. FIO's got some interesting stuff. Focal is there. Fosdex. I'm going to stop. Golden Ear.
Get there. Get there if you're interested.
Yeah. I'm going to try to.
Talk to these companies.
Yes. I'm actually kind of interested. Interesting. I didn't realize Philo is kind of replacing their X series portable media players, digital audio players. And they just announced the Philo M9 in Hong Kong.
Very cool.
Yeah, I didn't realize they also already have the M7, which is a handheld, a lossless, battery-powered music player. It's got aptX, aptX HD, LDAC, Bluetooth, a touchscreen. It's built on, I think, like a custom version of NAS. It's got an ESS Saber DAC built into it. It's like $200. Really curious to hear that. The M9 is particularly interesting to me because I believe it's going to add Wi-Fi, the ability to do streaming services. But they're small handheld players. You know, it's going to be built on the M9 is going to be built on Android, and it's kind of crazy because they're doing dual AKM 4490 DACs inside of there. And they're saying about 10 hours of continuous playback and support for up to, you know, if you actually have files like DSD 256. I don't think there's MQA support, but you know,
still
about the only way to get MQA is on Tidal. But I am very curious to hear the M9. It was supposed to ship in mid-September. I don't see it up on Amazon yet, but they've done some pretty impressive stuff. Like their engineering on the playback side, like their DACs and their headphone amps are always good. For me, it's always whether or not the software is kind of up to the quality of the hardware they're
providing. I hear you. A good app can make up for many things.
Well, it's like the interface. You know, how many times do I have to click to get to something I have to use regularly?
Sweet hardware deserves good software. I guess that's the short story. I'm trying to get a point across.
And I'm just tripping. Math is hard.
Oh, good golly.
Somebody had brought to my attention this crazy tweet where... what I thought was a picture that a guy had of the back of a HDMI cable that promised antivirus protection to reduce virus noises and to obtain a perfect image transmission. And it turns out that photo was going back. It was I was like, who in Australia is selling this? Because the guy who sent it out was in Australia. And it turns out this was from like 2012.
Making the rounds again.
Yeah, it was like I found the Gizmodo article. I think it was first published on in 2012. The Xbox 360 Elite HDMI cable.
Wow, that's targeted.
Antivirus protection to reduce virus noises.
It's good for a laugh.
Yeah. Those viruses attacking your HDMI cables are always scary.
Yeah. In case we're not being totally clear, any decent HDMI cable is going to work just right for you. There's nothing special to it. It's about 19 wires all going from point A to point B. You don't need anything additional in that line going from that point A to point B.
Yeah, I mean, basically between the two of us, I think I've replaced a lot of my HDMI cables in the last year, and partially because I've been getting a bunch of like 1 foot or 2 foot HDMI cables to make things fit better. And in other cases, like all of for the first few years of HDMI cables, there seemed to be this correlation between like, we're going to make a fat cable, a fat cable that can't do a radius under like 9 inches. I hate them all.
They were way too, well, I mean, that's just how it was. That was like the style of the time, yeah, where these ultra thick cables, the thicker it is, the more premium it is, or something to that effect.
Yeah. But
no, you really don't. And you can shop at places like Amazon or Monoprice or wherever to get very affordable cables. The one reminder I'm going to give everyone is that if you are trying to push a 4K 24 signal with uncompressed color like 444 or RGB with a 10-bit color code words, or you're looking at something like 4K 60 output from a device with either 420 like you'd see encoded on an ultra-high-def Blu-ray movie, or 422 maybe out of devices like your Chromecast Ultra with 10-bit color usually, again, you want to look for cables that are rated for at least 18 gigabits per second. I think that's the max you're going to find anyway. But just make sure when you're shopping to look at the specs. It should be listed right there, and it should say something along the lines of, yes, this is a full bandwidth 18 gigabit per second cable compared to many other older cables, if it's unlabeled or it doesn't say anything, it's likely a 10.2 gigabit per second cable, which works just fine with many things. But when you start pushing the high resolution, high color, it can result, if the cable's not able to keep up, it can result in either like a pink or green screen or simply no picture at all. There's my quick reminder for the HDMI goodness out there.
Well, I mean, it's something like we were talking about before the show. I have to pull the HDMI cable that goes from my AVR to my projector. I have to pull a new cable through there.
How long do you need? And you're only dealing with 1080p though right now.
15 feet, but that's just it though. Is I don't want
okay. If it's only 15 feet, you can get a good 4K cable.
I mean, because it's literally going up through the closet into the ceiling and down to the center of the room. So it's probably, you know, I'll get a 25 foot cable.
Oh yeah, you won't push 4K over that unless it's a special cable of some kind.
But 25 foot?
Yeah.
Really?
That's pretty. 20 feet's usually the limit.
Huh.
It's hard to find unless
it's funny because
unless it's amplified or chipped on each end or built to extremely good tolerances, it's something I would definitely test a signal through at full band, whatever the max bandwidth is before it's installed.
Well, it's interesting because when you start digging through Monoprice, if you search your HDMI cables and then you can find a checkbox way down at the bottom column on the left, like literally the last box. You can hit a checkbox for bandwidth, and they have their 18 gigabit per second. There's 15 18 gigabit per second cables.
I'll look through that and see what they're offering that go beyond the standard, say, 15 feet that's safe for just about any 18 gigabit per second cable.
They start at it starts at like $3.51 for their commercial series, and that goes from
ideally, if you're running this
5 feet up to 50 feet.
Interesting. I'll have to see how they're...
I wonder if...
Well, might be time for a test.
They're claiming like, you know, and they also have active cables. So basically, you're telling me keep it under 20 feet if I'm going with a passive cable.
If you're trying to push the full 4K bandwidth, something approaching that full saturation of 18 gigabit per second with the, you know, HDMI 2 format. Mm-hmm. And if you're not dealing with that, you have way more options. And it'll work with just about any cable, really. But I would still... always test a cable before you install it. And if you're going to be running it through your ceiling or in your walls, it's best to get an in-wall rated cable as well.
Look, here's a CL2 rated cable right now.
There you go.
The Monoprice Cabernet Ultra Series Active High-Speed HDMI Cable.
Active. There you go. I have heard reports that some people claim that active cables, the kind that have little chips in them that basically can help extend that length of the cable beyond the normal 20 feet, can have some compatibility problems with certain TVs, but I generally don't experience that. I try to avoid those kind of cables in regular use just for any chance that there could be a compatibility issue. And at the ultra high end of running, you know, long runs of something that will handle any bandwidth, it's going to be a fiber. That suddenly the price jumps way up compared to just a simple cable. A fiber is a great option if you really need to do a good long run and you don't ever want to think about the bandwidth. In the future, if the interconnects, the plugs change, you could easily re-terminate the cable and have it be compatible with some other kind of connector. Like, say, you know, I don't know, whatever. I can't picture anything replacing HDMI anytime soon. So I think you're good to go.
Yeah, unless you're gaming, but that's a whole other problem.
Oh yeah.
All right. So we'll get more into active versus passive in the near future.
Yeah, you know what? I've been purposely avoiding active cables for a little while now, just since the 4K HDR thing, and I think it's time I at least test a few just to see if any are worthy of my stamp of approval.
Copy that.
So. Oh yeah.
So, the 85-inch Samsung Q900R QLED 8K TV.
85 inches for $15,000. Oh. Available for pre-order right now.
Bargain at half the price.
Shipping apparently at the end of October. Favorite things about the new Q900R QLED 8K TVs. Number one, if the specs pan out, 4,000 nits of light output with full array local dimming, 8K worth of pixels. I see, at least in the press release Samsung sent out, no word yet on pricing or availability for anything smaller at this point, as far as screen sizes go. Without a doubt, my favorite thing about this particular TV is that it is a 4,000 nit consumer display with apparently, and supposedly, we'll test all of this eventually here, with 100% DCI P3 color. And what that will enable is effectively no tone mapping for any of today's 4K HDR content. It doesn't have to say, oh, I have a limited light output or I have a limited color palette compared to what the content on the disc or being streamed in 4K is actually providing. And I have to remap this to a lower performance TV. This TV kind of hits a performance level that is equal to what the mastering suites are in Hollywood actually crafting content for at the high end. Not everyone is producing 4,000 nit Blu-rays as far as being authored at that level, but there are a few of them out there now.
In the context of sort of studio quality / professional television or movie production monitors, $15,000 is actually a bargain.
For 85 inches and 8K, it's just nobody else is offering anything like this. And you add on top of that, cool features too, like being able to do variable refresh rate, auto game mode, and other things Samsung's really been pushing along. Those features are cool too, but really it's just having that spec of the 4,000 nits plus 100% DCI P3. Now granted, HDR10 and Dolby Vision and all of those cool formats of HDR goodness are capable of supporting code words up to 10,000 nits. But it'll probably be a little while longer, at least another year or two before we have a TV pushing that light level output. However, the 4,000 nit level, again, is just great because that's currently one of the max levels that Hollywood and other organizations use when they're producing HDR content. I see very few mastering displays in popular use that exceed 4,000 nits. This TV should be able to produce, with very little processing, the exact experience that the author intended. That could result in something amazingly fantastic. And we'll see, though. This is an LCD TV. It may have issues related to off-axis viewing, like most do. We haven't actually seen the performance of the full-array local dimming. Can it even come close to what a beautiful OLED can do? Although, you're not getting an 80-inch OLED anytime soon, so.
We can dream.
Yes. It's available. 15K for that big one. No idea what's happening with, like, say, a 65-inch version or something in the realm of reasonableness. Although, hey, if I had that 85-inch show up at the end of October, I wouldn't be disappointed.
I would imagine not.
And speaking of TVs, hey, I noticed that the LG C8, that's the 2018 C model, the step up from the B series that gives you the A9 processor with all of its fancy tricks. I think we talked a little bit about that last week. It is on sale right now at its lowest price I've seen on Amazon. And as soon as I mentioned that, I was looking specifically at the 55-inch model. I want to say it was just under $2,000 for the first time, a few hundred dollars off of what it was. I had a Twitter reply from @MrMatt83, and he's like, meh, my local Fry's had the C8 65-inch for $2,200 in-store only. And I was immediately like, you know, that's a damn good price for the 65-inch C8 OLED that typically retails closer to $3,000.
Yeah.
And it reminds me to really, I really should cruise over to my local Fry's once in a while because I tend not to pay attention to their ads as much. Even though they are a local store, it's like I'm more about having the damn thing shipped right to my door than it is going to a store and actually picking it up. But I'm not everyone is that way. So.
I got to say, I like to go into the stores just to hear what people are talking about and see what's on display. I mean,
but that's a great price for the 65-inch. That's like $200 more than Amazon's current low price for the 55-inch.
Right.
So, good deal to be had.
If you haven't been in a Best Buy in a while, it's interesting to look at how they've reorganized all the speaker displays because basically instead of having a bunch of speakers in a single area, not in the Magnolia, but in the actual regular Best Buy floor displays, you know, a couple of vendors like aren't there anymore, and each vendor has its own specific corral, its own specific area. It's curious to watch how stuff shifts and what that tells you about how they're marketing stuff when people make the pilgrimage to, I want to say, Minnesota to go see Best Buy.
Mildly off topic, but yet again, I walk into my local Costco, and they have a C8 OLED sitting right up front, tempting everyone's eyeballs. The funniest thing about LG's OLED panel technology in general is the way the polarizer is on that screen. Yeah. If you're wearing sunglasses and you walk into that store, that screen looks black with most regular polarized sunglasses. Oops. However, if there happens to be a Sony OLED based on that similar LG panel right next to it, Sony rotated the polarizer so that you can still see the screen even with polarized sunglasses on. So it's just odd. If you are creating a beach bar or somewhere where people often wear sunglasses right. when frequenting your establishment, consider Sony OLEDs over LGs. Otherwise, you're going to have a bunch of sunglass people turning their head sideways to see the picture. And
I hate that.
I just find it funny.
It is funny.
It's a quirky thing about LG's OLEDs in particular, and I don't see anyone else doing it that way. But how many companies are actually producing those OLEDs? Not many.
Well, maybe their sunglasses are different in Korea.
Hey, and as you mentioned at the top of the show in the intro, Big Lebowski, available for pre-order in 4K HDR Blu-ray, arriving October 16th.
So let me see.
That's in my inbox right now, or in my cart, ready to say, please, yes.
I was going to say, you've bought it on VHS,
I don't know if I've ever had it on VHS.
So DVD.
Probably. Oh, yeah, most definitely.
You have at least Blu-ray. 3 copies of the HD DVD.
At that 10th anniversary.
You were stockpiling it.
Blu-ray edition.
Then they finally came out with the Blu-ray edition, and you bought that. Now you're buying the 4K.
And then for Christmas, I got the Talking Jesus doll with the the bowler. And
Jimmy, do you anticipate uncovering
an adult toy? It actually says most of the lines from the movie coming out of this little doll. That's in my storage unit somewhere. I got to dig that up.
You should. I'll be very curious to hear what you think because it's a Coen Brothers film. The transfers have always been pretty good.
It depends on what the film stock.
Sure.
This will give you a really good look, considering they probably aren't going to do a hell of a lot to it. They're just going to do the film scans, basic conversion, get it onto digital, and then ship it. I took a look at, say, 2 weeks ago, the original Predator in 4K Ultra High Def Blu-ray. And that is just like looking at whatever the original source material was. Every scene's a little different. There's more noise in the darker jungle scenes compared to the brightly lit scenes, even within the same camera shot. It really highlights anything that was wrong with that movie that other formats or lesser resolution or lesser dynamic range kind of helped mask a little bit. It actually enabled me, or didn't enable me, it actually encouraged me to turn on a little bit of noise reduction on a TV to help, just so the transitions weren't so obvious in terms of, wow, there's a lot of noise grain in this picture from the camera being gated wide open, going to this brightly lit scene. And while I normally suggest for any premium source of video material, you just turn off noise reduction on a TV altogether, as there is a chance it will smooth and soften the picture. However, if you're finding you're focusing on grain artifacts, either it be noise or other things like that, that's where you really do want to enable at least a little bit of noise reduction just to help quell those angry pixels.
It's funny because some films, Patton was one where they kind of overcompensated, eliminated the film grade and make everybody, like the original Blu-ray, I remember being like, it's a little cartoon-like for my taste.
Especially if the grain's inconsistent, where it's like, it just depends on the scene and everything was shot on film. And
But there are some, I don't want to films, aesthetic choices, some things that DP did or simply because they're shooting in low light. The grain can be really, really, really obvious.
See, I haven't looked at the remake of... Did they ever do The Wizard of Oz into 4K Ultra High Def?
Not that I know of, but they scanned it and corrected it in 8K. So
chances are they even that out. And a lot of that was shot in studios with very controlled lighting and things like that as well.
It was almost entirely shot in studios.
So you compare that to my Predator experience in the jungles of... I don't know, Costa Rica, wherever the hell they shot that movie. But anyway, it didn't detract from the movie at all, but I was sitting close enough to the screen where I could really pick up how the noise was changing throughout the picture. And at that point, I said, you know what, I'm just going to turn noise reduction on low for both the MPEG artifacts in addition to just the general noise reduction feature as well. So
apparently, there was a 2017 4K version of The Wizard of Oz, but I don't remember seeing it for sale in the U.S.
Got it. And it might not have been HDR. It might have just been 4K or something. Anyway, see, because considering how well that movie was treated and restored, I'd be curious to see what the final result was.
Yeah.
In terms of just, general noise and things like that in the picture. I'm sure it looks fantastic.
Well, there's
that's
so much information.
That's probably not a good example to use.
For HDR?
Or just at least to see, like, in terms of how much noise reduction to enable for a movie like that. Right. I probably would turn it all off. But then I'm thinking also for some of the older James Bond movies, too, if any of those are in 4K UHD. Ah, suddenly I've got a new project here. Anyway.
So many movies to watch.
Oof.
So, did a review on this on TechThing a couple weeks ago. Netgear Orbi, which is the wireless mesh system I use in my house, and now my garage. I'll explain that in a second. They released an update, a new satellite, which the Orbi Voice Smart Speaker, or actually the Orbi Mesh Wi-Fi System with Orbi Voice Smart Speaker, I think is the official sort of Amazon title. So this thing is an Orbi satellite. It packs ALEXA, and they had Harman Kardon engineer a speaker into it. It's much fatter than a regular Orbi. It's like 1 3/4, maybe 2 Orbis thick, and they go from 4 Ethernet jacks to 2 Ethernet jacks. ALEXA works like ALEXA. The audio, I was a little nervous about the audio, and then I realized I have to spend some more time with Amazon Music because Amazon Music sounded horrendous. It sounded very, very compressed. I don't know if that was the settings on my account or that's sort of the quality of the music. But I got Spotify running through it and it sounded a lot better.
Oh, good.
I'm still tweaking with it because there's a bunch of options to play around with in there. You can pre-order it now, but they're not shipping it until October 28th when they do a full update for all the Orbi systems. I think Sonos has some audio advantages, but this is really impressive. If for no other reason than it combines a whole bunch of stuff. They wrapped it with fabric, so it's a little more aesthetically appealing. Not that the Orbi, the Orbis kind of look like vases, like something you'd buy off of Etsy or I can't think of the name of that furniture company that's over at the mall.
I hear you. So cool. Orbi makes that mesh Wi-Fi system, and now they have a smart speaker product.
Yeah. They've got an option where they packed a cable modem into one, and the cable modem was actually a discrete device from the router in the box, which I thought was a smart decision. They also have an outdoor, sort of a IP57 rated outdoor version that's waterproof and dustproof.
Actually, I like having the cable box separated out as a good thing anyway, because
I do too, but
you could be, unless it supports the very latest standards, you may eventually get service that would require you to have a different cable modem in order for it to support that higher speed functionality.
I agree with you on that, but I've always
just purchased my own cable routers. Cable modems, excuse me.
Yeah, no, we both own cable modems. I still probably would not buy that product, but I had a very intense high-speed conversation with the product manager, and he alleviated about 90% of my fears. The one fear you can't really alleviate is like, okay, if they go to DOCSIS 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8, then you not only have to replace your cable modem, but your router too.
You generally have backward compatibility. You just might not get the absolute performance that you may be paying for. Once you get up to like DOCSIS 3, 3.1, is your internet service pushing more than 200 megabits or something like that? And that's where you really need to start paying attention to it. But otherwise, there's a whole range of products that'll support speeds up to 150 or so megabit per second.
You're talking about cable modems?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was really impressed because my ISP is a startup in the Bay Area that started in Alameda and has expanded to San Jose. So they've been having some provisioning issues with the folks that connect their fiber to the internet. But and mostly, I'm typically getting like 100 down and 100 up.
Oh, symmetric.
For $50 a month.
Yeah. That is that's what it should be priced at.
Yes. Yeah, I'm hoping they find success.
Very asymmetrical bandwidth around here, at least with our Comcast service. But at the same point, I'm using a Motorola, I think it's a surfboard cable router. I keep saying that. Cable modem. And the one nice thing about that is, at least with our service, is the updates get pushed automatically from the service provider.
That's a DOCSIS. That's part of the DOCSIS 3.0 spec. So it's basically, if you haven't unplugged, like if you haven't restarted your DOCSIS cable modem or your cable modem in a while, just unplug it or shut it down and restart, like let it sit, count to 30, plug it back in, because they don't do the upgrades until you restart it. And I remember restarting mine once and got like a 30 megabit jump in download performance
without a doubt. And I'm still rolling with the Amplify their HD product, and that thing is just chugging along.
I have no complaints about that. I got
to
send you their remote VPN to test. I got to bring that down here because I can't actually get it to run on my network at home because I don't have a public-facing IP address.
I probably do.
But that would allow you to tap into your server here at the house. I mentioned the Orbity Voice smart speaker has ended up in the garage of Hope and Caffeine, the garage of Hope and Coffee, because the boys were asking it to play their favorite Harry Potter book. They've been cycling through the Harry Potter audiobooks.
Very cool.
And of course, someone misspoke, and then someone tried to change the volume, and ALEXA responded. My wife was like, "I'm sorry, what is that?" And then asked it for tea, hot Earl Grey. I think that's the phrase of Captain Picard. And
yes.
It had a particularly amusing Easter egg kind of an answer. And she said, "That's awesome. Get it out of the house." So my voice, I am going to have the most sophisticated collection of voice control stuff in the garage at the rate I'm going.
I am literally the user of ALEXA where I enable the mic, mm-hmm. I'll do the command I need, and I disable the mic immediately. Just like... one too many times, it'll pick up a word from the TV or something and trigger and just be a little disruptive more than I want it to be. And I'm like, nah. I don't use it for that much, to be honest with you.
I can't remember. Is this a family-friendly podcast? Because there's a really good joke in there.
But probably. Yes. Yes, we are family-friendly. Very.
I definitely can't make that joke. More on this next week. But Kavo sent me their control center for a review. This
cool.
is really, yeah,
actually surprising for me. I was just like, oh, that kind of came out of nowhere.
Yes, that was the exact thought. Like, I got an email and they're like, "Hey, you looked at this. Do you want to look at this?" And I'm like, "Where did this come from?"
I think a short story is they took like every suggestion you could possibly throw at them and rolled it into a new product that costs less.
A quarter the price. So it's
not as artistically, aesthetically beautiful.
No.
As the original with its bamboo wood trim and things like that.
Well, but, it was swappable.
Still, this hits a price point. I think that'll get much more attention.
Yeah.
And critically, HDR support.
Yeah. I mean, it's scaled back from the original Kavo. It's more of a Harmony remote competitor than sort of the claiming that they have AI and voice control solutions for all the things. But the voice control is still in there, but it's $99. HDR and Atmos compatible now, which the original $400 device wasn't. They say a Dolby Vision firmware update's coming. It's much smaller. It's like a quarter of the size. There's four HDMI inputs instead of eight, which is probably more than enough for the average human being. It's not enough for me, but I have a whole bunch of stuff I test because I do this for a living. There's no fancy wood cover. There's no $400 price tag. It does have sort of a little brass button that echoes the brass knobs that they used or elements that control did the cable management for the HDMI cables in the original Kavo. If you press the copper button or brass button, whatever color this metallic button is, because it's sitting in the dark in my closet and I'm too busy, you know, setting things up to really pay attention to the aesthetics, bad me. But if you press the button, then the remote control starts singing, which I'm a big fan of. That's very much like the Roku boxes.
Yes.
There is either a $20 a year or a $2 a month fee, which I have mixed feelings about because I never want to pay for anything. But I also believe in paying people for making software that works. So if they continue to update it, I think it's a smart choice on their part.
If it makes your use or the family's use of the system easier, that's a reasonable fee.
Yeah.
Especially $20 a year.
And it's, you know, the
couple cups of coffee.
Yeah. Local. Yeah. $2 is not a lot of money for something that makes your life easier a month. Much like the original Kavo, you run your HDMI inputs into the Kavo control center. The Kavo control center gets plugged into an HDMI input on your AVR. It's got the overlays on the screen. The voice control is still there. It works with ALEXA and Google Home. I think the setup was a lot easier than the original Kavo, and it's a little less traumatic. If, for example, I still have that Homeworks TV tuner / PVR that you gave me a while ago. I think I'm going to try to replace that because I was able to set up the manual controls for it, but part of me would also like to see something that's actually recognized by some of the home automation systems.
Right.
Next week, I'll talk about the setup and watch lists and the voice control and
cool.
the performance and if it works with my projector. But this was an interesting alternative to a Harmony remote.
This was one of those products where literally after that initial, the delayed release of the initial product had us all kind of thinking, you know, maybe the company's done. Maybe they burned through all the money they had and it's just kaput. They come back with something that's going to be popular at that price point, far more so than 4X the price. And it does many of the same things that the previous product did with even all the quirks ironed out. And that just sounds fantastic. And I'm glad to see the Kavo folks hanging in there.
No, it's
and
it's
doing it.
It's a smart choice because I think they realized that not having HDR was a huge problem, given that most of the early adopters are buying 4K televisions that have HDR in them. I think they recognized that pretty quickly. And some of the stuff that was super quirky about the voice control, I'm going to get deeper into that, but you know, one of the issues with the original ones where you would kind of ask it to go to a particular program on a particular service, and it would sort of dump you into the home screen to that service, then you would have to start clicking around with the remote. The remote's also a little smaller, which I think makes it a lot easier to handle.
Oh, cool.
But again, more detail on that next week. Philip, a.k.a. at Schumann Projects, tweets, at AVXL, at Patrick Norton, new home theater setup. Any thoughts for Blu-ray playback, dedicated player, game console, or full disc rip to NAS? And my first response is yes, because Blu-rays are better than streaming.
Oh, without a doubt.
You've ripped, Shannon's done this too, you've ripped pretty much all the Blu-rays to a NAS or to a server in your house.
DVDs and Blu-rays are relatively easy to deal with in terms of extracting that content and putting it on a box that can be played back. And there are programs out there that will even convert it into a single file, yeah, which is awfully convenient, as say a format like MKV is a wrapper for whatever the video content is. Those files are generally compatible with every TV out there that has a media player built into it nowadays, or any set-top box or OTT box, like, mm-hmm, say, your Roku Ultra. That's super convenient. If you're looking to play the raw ISO files, that could be a little trickier, but I'm sure things like Plex and other services can provide the necessary playback tools or Kodi in a nice interface that's right there on the TV. It's just the matter of DVDs take up relatively little space compared to, say, a Blu-ray. And then you jump up to a 4K ultra high def disc, and suddenly you're talking, you know, 50 to 100 megs or 100 gigs per title if you want everything off of that disc. Beyond that, I would probably take a dedicated Blu-ray player over an Xbox. I have to look up to see how updated the Xbox is now after it got past its initial teething pains of ultra-high-def disc playback. Does it support things like Dolby Vision? Does that really matter? Do any of the discs you have, are they Dolby Vision compatible? That would be nice to have a player that supported both discs so you didn't have to think about which format is the ultra-high-def, ultra HD 4K HDR experience to purchase. I'm also experimenting with Make MKV, which is a popular quote-unquote free app. If you have an appropriate optical drive, you can find the right list of keys for various movie titles out there. You can actually decode and dump ultra high def Blu-ray discs relatively easily nowadays. I just so happen to have such a drive, and the software is laying around, and that's something I'll be experimenting with in the next week or so, just to see what the practical playback mechanisms can be.
Sure.
I really want an interface like Kaleidoscape in terms of, I want jewel cases that I can scroll through, mm-hmm, very visual, select it, it just starts playing immediately, no stupid FBI warnings about, oh, don't pirate our movie. That's so annoying. You will only see those warnings on discs you purchased.
Yeah.
And it's like the better movies at least put that at the end after the credits have rolled, those warnings. Yeah. The worst movies put them right at the beginning. It's like, why are you wasting my time? If I were pirating this,
the waiting is over.
First thing I'd rip out of here is the warning. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean,
how you manage this content. It's like Kaleidoscape makes some amazing server hardware and front ends, yeah, for doing this very thing and doing it very, very well.
Well, you're not going to manage your own personal files on Kaleidoscape. You're going to buy their content. But it is my new sort of, like, when I'm picturing in my head what I want to do with Plex or any of the other,
you know, I haven't experimented for a while. I was using some older software on previous Windows, mm-hmm, versions, specifically like Windows 7 with Media Center, and using software like MyMovies.dk to create a very Kaleidoscape-like interface. And that worked fantastic back in the DVD and Blu-ray days. But going into ultra high def and the demise of Media Center, what are these other services out there? I'm just curious, too, if you are rolling streamed content off of, say, a NAS for full ISO rips of your favorite discs as backup, and you do have an interface that gets it right to your TV and lets you just enjoy at will, what are you using exactly? What mm-hmm. software in particular? What set-top box or OTT box? Are you doing this over a Roku with Kodi? Are you doing right. this with Plex and something else? If you have any insight into that, please drop us a line, ask at avxl.com, or tweet it out, at avxl, at Patrick Norton, at Robert Heron.
Because we're listening.
We are.
We're waiting for you.
And before I just start randomly Googling stuff and trying things and spending half a day on this, it's like, oh, no. Just go right here, Robert. Check this out.
Feel free to save us time and suffering and pain.
Number one!
We would really appreciate that.
I would!
Oh, my goodness. The Damien's got an RTX question. He writes, hey, guys, you posed the question if we'd like you to cover the new RTX NVIDIA cards. My answer is yes! I'm working to build a new top-end gaming machine and plan on buying the RTX after it hits. I don't want a first-run card, and I'm waiting to see the benchmarks. Good call.
Mm-hmm.
Nonetheless, Damien continues, beyond the card, it would be great if you'd shed some light on the state of HDR and PCs. I plan on using my LG OLED as the dedicated display over HDMI, but I'm lost when it comes to how HDR will pan out in the PC world. I saw some new specs for HDMR and luminance for monitors, so I'm guessing the market is finally catching up to home theater specs. However, I don't know what the video card's output and if HDCP will also be an issue. Your proud Patreon supporter, Damien from Wisconsin. And just let me get a quick shout out to all of our patrons, patreon.com/avxl. These are the people who pay a little bit each month and help make it possible for Robert and I to pay the bills for the hosting and the distribution and the website, and also a little money so we can actually afford to go out and buy some of this stuff and experiment with it. So please, if you enjoy the show, join Damien over at patreon.com/avxl and become a patron of the show.
Y'all rock.
Yeah. Thank you, Damien.
He's in luck.
Yeah.
Well, at least in Windows 10, HDR support's baked in now. And if you connect any HDR-compatible display device, including televisions, in the case of LG's OLEDs, generally they'll auto-detect that you're connecting to a high-bandwidth source in 4K, and it will automatically switch over to that high-bandwidth mode for the HDMI ports. And if it doesn't, most other TVs require you to manually do that. But once that's done, you can go right into the Windows display controls and enable HDR. And there are several games out now that already do support HDR. I'm also curious, too. I'm going to try this today, actually. I do have an HDR display right next to my workstation running an NVIDIA card. Not one of the new 20 series cards, but I have my 10 series that still chugs along. A couple things about those cards, the HDCP, they all seem to support 2.0 with compatible displays, so you don't have to worry about copy protection or anything like that in terms of the signaling going to the display.
Right.
That's no problem.
There has been some issues with Windows 10 support of HDR in gaming, and I think one of the big things about the April update for Windows 10 was...
I just don't know that many titles that support. I know Far Cry 5 did, and that's probably the first thing I'm going to go try this afternoon.
The part of the issue was that if you turned on HDR in Windows 10, all of your SDR stuff would look gray and murky.
Oh, it just forces everything? Well, see, this is where we need a... As we talked about with the Apple XS and XS Max...
Right.
Having something that could do automatic content detection and then switch the color palette between the wide color palette of, say, DCI used in HDR video production or the Rec. 709 standard, sRGB standard used in computers. It would be nice if the operating system were just aware of what the hell it was displaying.
Well, that's just it. Because
I can see that being a problem.
In the April update, they added the ability to sort of change the brightness for SDR content, and it still didn't make the SDR content look as good as it should or could, but it made it less murky and less painful. But in a lot of cases, you're still going to want to manually turn on HDR for gaming, unless there's something in the last update that I missed. It's been a little odd to watch, oh my goodness.
10-bit color out of computers is totally doable.
Yeah.
You can do 444 RGB.
And you were starting to see
60 hertz.
Gaming support's been an issue because there's some cases where like an Xbox version of a game supports HDR, but the PC version of the game doesn't support HDR. And part of that's because there's so few HDR monitors out there at this point, and they assume people aren't gaming in the living room.
Like there are far more people connecting to an HDTV.
Yeah.
Or a 4K ultra high def HDR TV than they are actually connecting to true.
Yeah.
Let alone HDR 1000 monitors are beautiful. Especially those two, I think, that have full array local dimming on that kind of a smaller screen, but they are insanely expensive. for that kind of technology. And otherwise, I'm a little meh about the whole state of HDR, either the HDR 400, 600, or 1000 spec monitors that are out there right now. I love the wide color palette. It's just trying to do HDR on a small screen is more expensive right now than is reasonable for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Especially when you start talking about local or full array local dimming on a relatively small screen, like something under 40 inches.
Well, there's also, your PC needs to have PlayReady 3.0 digital rights management. Otherwise, protected HDR content isn't going to play.
That should all be pretty automatic with Windows 10, at least.
It should be.
I'll play around with it.
Anybody out there who's playing with HDR stuff on their home theater PC or their gaming PC in their living room?
I have no excuse. I have two monitors. I'm also curious too. I currently have two monitors connected to my workstation, and I'm just going to plug in, and it has an available HDMI port that I'm just going to roll right up to the TV that's next to it.
Yeah.
And let's see if I can drive my two monitors plus a 4K TV in HDR and have that be the primary display when I'm gaming. We'll see how convoluted I can make this.
Yeah, in any case, HDR madness aside, I'm a little torn on the RTX GPUs. The 2080 Ti is pretty badass for 4K, but it's also incredibly expensive. The RTX 2080 is basically more expensive. You know, they're selling, I think, for about $800, $850 right now. They're more expensive than a GTX 1080 Ti, but they perform about the same. And I bring that up, the perform about the same, because there's no RTX games yet. The next, Lara Croft game is going to ship, is supposed to ship with RTX support. The next Battleground's supposed to, they're going to do an update for that to support RTX, but there's not, you're paying a premium. So waiting on that card is definitely a very, very good idea.
I think so for most people. The benefits or the performance potential issues with doing something like adding ray tracing effects to a game are kind of still unknown in terms of seeing actual shipping titles.
Yeah.
One of my favorite features of the new NVIDIA RTX cards is the DLSS. What is that? The deep learning super sampling.
Yeah.
AI powered anti-aliasing system. That simply requires more time to fully flesh out. I don't think any game currently supports that outside of a demo at this point. That could be the one feature that gets me to move up. Being able to do like something that approaches just perfect deinterlacing for even less overhead.
Right.
But it requires machine learning on the back end in order to make it all work. And that just simply takes time to get processed, go through the game titles that are popular. Can this eventually just be supplied locally to any game you throw at it? We'll see. There's a lot of cool features there, but in terms of absolute performance currently, the 1080 Ti, that beast still holds up. So
yeah, I mean, the
at least until these newer features like ray tracing and DLSS kick in.
Yeah, I mean, the 2080 Ti is just shipping. All the Founders Edition cards are $100 more than the regular cars. HDR 1000 spec monitors are insanely expensive. There just aren't that many of them out there. I like the idea that Vace is coming up with sort of HDR certification spec for monitors, but most of the monitors out there are like HDR 400, which ironically at 400 nits makes them as bright as a lot of the 2017 TVs.
That's Rec 709 color too.
Yeah.
So that's not even, I'd still rather have a monitor that's not claiming any kind of crazy light output, but can still at least do the wide color palette and offer a good contrast ratio.
Yeah.
That's where it's kind of stepping next. And then as soon as somebody can come up with a way to do full array local dimming at small scales with good granularity in terms of screen sizes, that's going to be where it just suddenly becomes like, oh yeah, every monitor is going to be this way. But currently, like one of the very best HDR 1000 spec monitors I've seen that does a really fine grid of full array LEDs,
right?
That's just a couple grand right now for the monitor. And that's out of the prices. Or I'd rather spend that on a new workstation right now. So or a 65-inch LG OLED.
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of the state of HDR and PCs is A, it's evolving. B, your mileage is going to vary a lot depending on whether or not your favorite games are HDR, what the latest updates to Windows 10 are. The RTX 2080, if you can pick up
if you got the cash and you're buying all new, what the hell? Might as well go big.
But that's, $850 if you can find one for sale. versus right now 1080 Ti's, which have the same performance on today's games, are selling for like $700 to $800.
I'm looking forward. I'm rolling a 1060, 6 gigabyte card, and yeah. I'm curious to see what, if any, kind of level of performance I can do. At least HDR, maybe not at 4K, but just getting HDR out of, say, Far Cry 5 at least 1080p. Something that scales nicely.
Did I say Battleground instead of Far Cry before?
I don't know. I missed. I'm sorry. But I know that game in particular does support HDR performance, because I had a client who was specifically wanting me to calibrate his TV, his beautiful Sony Z9D, specifically to play Far Cry 5 in HDR. And it looked damn good. So.
Yeah. It's not a long list at this point, right? Assetto Corsa, Competizione, Control. These are the games that will support real-time ray tracing. Battlefield 5, Enlisted Justice, Atomic Heart, JX3, MechWarrior 5, Mercenaries, Metro Exodus, Project DH from Nexon's DevCat Studio, Shadow of the Tomb Raider.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll just see what the performance is when enabling those kind of cool features.
It's a pretty big vig to buy a 20 series NVIDIA GPU right now for technology that hasn't been implemented in any game you can play.
If you are rolling a NVIDIA card, I do recommend the GeForce Experience app. That is just a nice way to check your drivers, check all of the installed titles for setting optimizations in an automated way. Makes it nice. Goodness.
Some nice audio gear I'm looking at, mostly entry level, but some of this punches way above its weight class. I'm kind of looking for a badass entry level stereo system to recommend. The way I can be like, just get a set of Sony 7506s and a shit full of two Q Acoustics 3020i speakers. The original 3020. These sell for $300 a pair. It's an update to the original 3020, which sells for $270. That's actually the Wirecutter's recommendation right now. I want to kind of compare those to the debut 2.0. Cambridge Audio has some interesting entry-level amps that are fairly inexpensive, like $200 for their Topaz AM5. I've got Emotiva's A100 Stereo Flex Amplifier, which is pretty badass for $229. I want to compare those to one of those $75, $50 amps. Little tiny amps, Class D amps that are all over Amazon.
All right.
I picked up RSL Speedwoofer off of Craigslist, the 10S. It is really impressive. Brent Butterworth gave me a heads up on that one. And then I have a beast of a subwoofer in. Like, I can barely move it. The Monolith by Monoprice, or 12-inch THX subwoofer. It sells for about $800. But I'm going to have I'm having some fun playing around with that.
Nice.
Terrifying the children during action movies.
Yes.
Our thoughts are with the family of Siegfried Linkwitz. I hadn't realized he had passed over the bar on September 11th. He's the co-inventor of the Linkwitz-Riley crossover. He's a speaker, designer, DIY enthusiast. Most of his later designs were fairly pure dipole speakers that give some astonishing performance and sound staging in some rooms that are incredibly not set up to make for good audio. He would do demos of his DIY designs at his home in Corte Madeira. I got to go up and see one of those. That's when I kind of became obsessed.
A devotee.
Yeah. His website is linkwitzlab.com, and there's just a ton of stuff there up on speakers and design and how stereo works.
LINKWITZ.
Yeah. LAB.com. I'm going to build a set of his LX minis because
there you go.
They're astonishing.
A fitting tribute.
Yes, that will be my fitting tributes. And, he and his wife were really lovely. And just want to give a shout out to Mr. Linkwitz and his contributions to the field of audio. Wrote a bunch of papers. He was a pretty hardcore engineer building testing gear, or basically running. He was a pretty senior engineer at HP for the better part of four decades. Nice guy.
Not a bad place to be, especially in the AV space.
Oh my goodness. And made some pretty badass speakers. So, one last thought before we go. If you have a question for us, ask at AVXL or tweet at Robert Heron or tweet at Patrick Norton. And if you got a minute, go over to patreon.com/AVXL and contribute. Please join us each and every week. If you are, if this is new, if you just found us, you can subscribe on iTunes, your favorite podcatcher. If you need the links, go to AVXL.com. And hey, Thank you so much. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
We'll catch you next week on AVXL.